You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk with one of the world's premier marine photographers about a life photographing whales.
First, on Friday, a federal judge blocked a Wisconsin law from being enforced. The law, sometimes known as the Cocaine Mom Law, allows the state to detain women suspected of drug or alcohol abuse during their pregnancies.
The law, known as Act 292, was passed almost 20 years ago, and it's been a controversial one. The judge's ruling last week is the result of a lawsuit filed in 2014 by a Wisconsin woman who claimed the law is unconstitutional.
David Wahlberg has been covering the controversy around the law for the last few years. He's the health medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, and he joins us now. David, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Well, David, under this law, before it was blocked, what happens if you're a pregnant woman and you're found to have used drugs or alcohol during your pregnancy?
Yeah, well, many people are probably familiar with the law that allows social workers to remove a child if there's abuse or neglect suspected from a home, or at least give the child services. Basically, what this law did about 20 years ago is extend those protections to unborn children or fetuses. So if social workers suspected abuse through drug use or alcohol use in a pregnant woman, they could detain the woman, they could order her to have treatment, and eventually they could, once the baby was born, could also remove the baby from the home.
And has that happened over the years? What are the numbers on that?
Yeah, so between 2005 and 2014, there were more than 3,000 cases that were screened through the law, and then the state substantiated claims of abuse of fetuses against 467 women. And according to the National Advocates for Pregnant Women, which is one of the groups that was representing the woman in this case, there were at least 152 cases in which people removed children from the home.
And you write that the law allows the state to step in, as you were saying, and essentially treat the fetus as if it were a child suffering neglect or abuse, and I believe that the fetus is appointed an attorney. Is that unusual?
Yeah, according to this national group that I just mentioned, there are a few other states that have laws similar to this one in Wisconsin, but they say Wisconsin was the only one where, during these cases, an attorney would be appointed to represent the fetus, but the pregnant woman wasn't necessarily able to get an attorney to represent her.
So if you're a pregnant woman and you go in for some health care, maybe some screenings, maybe it's a prenatal appointment, and it's discovered that there is maybe some illegal drugs or alcohol in your system, what happens? How does a woman end up from being in that position to maybe being in custody?
Well, I know I've done stories about neonatal abstinence syndrome, and doctors who deal with that, which is a condition that babies can have when they're born dependent on drugs, they deal with a lot of pregnant women that some of whom are using substances, and they say it's pretty rare that the authorities would do anything. In most cases, doctors are glad that the women are open and honest and basically get them treatment through their pregnancy.
Now, can you walk us through the lawsuit that was filed in 2014 pertaining to this law and what happened?
So this woman, Tammy Lorcher, she lived in Medford, which is up sort of halfway between Wausau and Eau Claire. And she suspected that she was pregnant. She had done a home pregnancy test, and it was positive, but she had a thyroid condition that led her to believe she would have a hard time becoming pregnant, so she wasn't sure. So she went to the health department and then to a clinic and got a pregnancy test, and it did determine that she was 14 weeks pregnant. She did acknowledge that she had used some substances, methamphetamine, marijuana, and alcohol, but she said she stopped that when she thought she was pregnant. Basically, because of her And then a urine test at the time showed that she still had some of those substances in her body. So a judge ordered her into drug treatment, and she refused, saying she didn't need it. And so because of that, she was taken to jail, and she was in jail for 18 days. And for part of that time, about 36 hours, she was in solitary confinement.
We're talking with David Wahlberg right now, health and medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, joining us to talk about a recent ruling from a federal judge to block Wisconsin's so-called cocaine mom law from going into effect. The law allows the state to detain women suspected of drug or alcohol abuse during their pregnancy. And David, the federal judge blocked this law at this point. On what grounds? Why was the law blocked?
Yeah, so basically the law says that the social workers can act on behalf of the state if the expectant mother habitually lacks self-control in her use of substances and the use poses a substantial risk to the physical health of the unborn child. And the judge basically ruled that those two things, this habitual lack of self-control and this substantial risk to the physical health of the unborn child, were just too vague. They were constitutionally vague, or unconstitutionally vague, I should say, because it's hard to interpret what they really mean.
And what have opponents of the law, especially women's health advocates, had to say about this?
Well, they're pretty happy with it. You know, their point is that they should be encouraging pregnant women to get prenatal care and to be open about drug use or alcohol use so they can get them help and do what they can to make sure they have a healthy pregnancy. So, you know, they're very happy with this ruling.
And what about the state of Wisconsin, the Department of Justice?
So the Department of Justice could appeal this ruling, but so far they're saying that they're still reviewing it and they haven't decided whether to do that.
And so in terms of what doctors might say about the efficacy of this law, if the goal is to protect the health of the fetus and the baby when it's born, what did doctors say about whether it's been effective?
I don't know that much what they say about that. You know, I think they basically say that, you know, the most effective thing is to encourage prenatal care, you know, regardless of whether somebody is using substances, because that's the best way to, you know, monitor a pregnancy and attempt to have a healthy birth.
And now that this law has been blocked, is this the end of the road or is it going to be challenged?
Well, it could be challenged, and it'll be interesting to see because back 20 years ago when the state legislature passed the law, some of the state departments were actually opposed to it. So the State Division of Public Health, which is part of the Department of Health Services, and also the former Division of Children and Family Services, which is now the Department of Children and Families, were opposed to the law back then. I don't know for sure exactly what the different departments' stances on the law is today. I've asked about that, and I haven't heard back.
We'll leave it there. David, thank you for joining us.
Sure. Good to be here.
That was David Wahlberg. He's the health and medicine reporter for the Wisconsin State Journal, joining us to talk about a recent ruling from a federal judge to block Wisconsin's so-called cocaine mom law from going into effect. As SeaWorld ends its controversial practice of breeding orcas in captivity for its theme park, our next guest has spent his life photographing whales in the wild.
Charles Nicklin, who goes by the name Flip, learned a lot from his father, who is also one of the top marine photographers in the world. By some measures, most of the published images of whales in circulation were taken either by Flip Nicklin or his father.
Charles Flip Nicklin joins us now. He'll be appearing in Madison as part of the National Geographic series at Madison's Overture Center on Tuesday, May 2nd. The event is called Among Giants, A Life with Whales. Flip, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
Well, you've said that looking into the eye of a whale or a dolphin changes you, and you go on to say, I wish everyone had that experience. How does it change you?
Well, I guess I can say the first big story I did for National Geographic was sharks, and enjoyed the 2 years I spent doing research with sharks and looking in sharks' eyes. And there was just a big difference between looking in the shark eye that didn't give you that much back and looking into a whale or dolphin eye, where at least the way I saw it, they were saying so much without saying anything.
So do you feel when you are up close with a whale or a dolphin and you are having that eye-to-eye contact, do you feel as though there's some kind of communication that's passing between you somehow?
Oh, certainly. I think the nonverbal communication, as you feel with a dog or a child before it can talk, there's all kinds of communication that's going on, body language, tilts of the head. You're getting all kinds of stuff if you're tuned in to what's going to happen and what's happening.
Do you ever track particular whales, for instance, from season to season, from shoot to shoot, and you almost feel like you get a sense for their personality like you would with a dog?
Well, yes, and one of the things that I discovered as I started doing this 40 years ago was that there are over 80 types of whales, dolphins, and porpoise, and there are different cultures and different setups where humpback whales in Hawaii, we very seldom see the same whale 2 days in a row, and maybe we'll see the same one every couple of years. So it's not that ongoing relationship. In Alaska, where they're feeding, we see the same whale every day. And you're right, when you get into types of whales, dolphins, cetaceans, that there are different cultures, there's different subgroups, and there's different individual personalities. And I think that we usually talk in great generalities about these animals, but it gets back to the individual being the thing that changes from day to day, minute to minute.
Now, I know that photographing whales and dolphins, it runs in your family. Your dad paved the way for you. He had a legendary career as a marine photographer. What did you learn from him along the way?
That if you're easy to work with, there'll be more work. And I think the biggest thing with following my father, who's still, my father's going to be 90 in September. He's planning his underwater birthday party in Micronesia. So,
wow.
And everywhere I went, being Chuck's son, at least gave people, they would give me a chance. They'd let me in. They'd give me an in that maybe an unknown photographer might not get. But following him because of who he was, not what he did, was the important thing.
And I read this story that you were photographing sperm whales off the coast of Sri Lanka, and you actually ran into your father underwater, who was, I guess, doing the same thing.
My brother and I were on one boat doing research and dove under a group of animals freediving and saw people in the foreground. It was my dad and his assistant, and and I think we both told the other guy to get out of the way.
You know? That's crazy. Well, I guess when it runs in your family, that might happen from time to time.
And certainly all my diving, all this stuff came from my dad, especially in 1963 when my dad rode a whale and was one of the first guys to photograph whales underwater. That changed life for him and for me.
Right, and your father opened a dive shop before he had this huge career, and I understand that, for instance, Jacques Cousteau used to shop at this dive store he ran. Did you ever get to meet Jacques Cousteau and mingle with him at all?
I did. I was just a little kid, but I met him and his son, Philippe, who was killed in the plane crash, was a hero of mine growing up. And diving was very, very small. So there were only two dive shops in San Diego. But there's still Jacques came and talked to one of the dive classes. Some of those guys are still around telling people that Jacques Cousteau told them to talk to their dive class. Of course, nobody believes them.
You mentioned free diving a little bit ago. Can you talk about what free diving is and how you got into it?
Well, I started free diving when I was about 12. Snorkeling. Fins, mask, and snorkel, take a big breath and go down. The simplest kind of diving. I've always preferred that to all the gear. I did that in the 60s. If you came in and wanted to learn to scuba dive, we'd want you to be a free diver first or a snorkeler first. And often my father would try and encourage people to get a wetsuit, fins, mask, and snorkel, and free dive for months before they thought about getting into scuba.
What is that experience like? I understand you can go down something like 90 feet. What is it like when you're shooting photographs and you're kind of stripped free? You're almost not quite a dolphin, but you're a little more in that natural element.
Well, yeah, I in talking about the photography of these animals, especially that kind of diving, we were diving 60, 70, 80 feet, just imagine holding your breath for 30 or 40 seconds and then see how much you can think about art.
Hmm.
I mean, mainly it was dive down, stay as long as you could, hope to get something. And I think of it as sort of enlightened snapshots where all your planning had to be before you made the dive, because when you were down there, you just didn't have time and you weren't thinking very clearly.
What have you photographed down there when you're free diving?
Almost all the whale stuff I've done has been free diving. Probably 99% of the pictures I've ever taken of whales, dolphins, and porpoise underwater has been snorkeling. And today, that's all I do. And it's worked out pretty well. One of the things is a lot of marine mammals use bubbles as a signaling device, as a display. And so to go down there and be blowing bubbles and making some kind of a display where you don't know what you're saying to an 80,000-pound animal just didn't seem to make too much sense. If I could dive down there quietly, holding my breath, I was just less likely to change the behavior I was trying to photograph.
We're talking with Flip Nicklin right now, one of the world's premier marine photographers. He has decades of experience, known for his photographs of whales and dolphins, and he's the author of the book Among Giants, A Life with Whales. And Flip, I know you really believe in the power of a photograph to tell a story. In fact, you say that you tell young photographers that your photograph should have a story behind it, that you could almost talk for an hour about this photograph. And I wonder if you could share a story or two with us about one of the photographs you've taken and the story behind it.
Oh, sure. And this is an above-water picture, but I think people can relate to it. Is everybody seen a picture of a breaching whale, a whale jumping out of the water? And when digital photography was new, we found a young yearling humpback whale jumping over and over again. My research partner, Jason Sturgis, was in the water shooting video, and this animal would come up as like a year-old calf leaving mom. Jason could see it coming, so he could hoot through his snorkel, and I'd know the animal was going to come up. And I ended up getting some very nice images of Jason in the foreground, this whale exploding out of the water. And the fun thing was we could have digital. I could show it to him when he got out of the water. We could go to other research folks and show them the picture. Everybody thought it was great until we showed Jason's mother, Judy. And, of course, her question was, do whales always jump away from you?
Hmm.
So there's a million stories. If we work 100 days doing stuff as we do in Hawaii, there'll be 2 or 3, 4 hours of the situations that might make pictures that will be shown when I'm in Madison. And you remember those pictures. And most of them you could go on and on about because they were so hard fought to get.
And you've had decades doing this, I imagine hundreds and hundreds of dives at this point. Is there a dive that sticks with you that you remember as being just special and different from the others?
Well, yeah, there is, and there are quite a few. But I was photographing what we call a friendly humpback. It was two animals under the boat. They came back over and over again right under the boat, moving slowly, and I slipped in the water. And this animal came up very, very close. A whale can't swim backwards. So the first time the whale slipped by, the second time it put on the brick. It stopped right next to me, rolled into me, and picked me up on its pectoral fin and brought me up to its eye. Like you'd pick up a grasshopper and take a look at it.
Wow.
And I'll show a video clip of that in a couple days.
Oh, my goodness. What did that feel like?
You know, I don't know. People always ask what I'm thinking. I'm not thinking. I'm trying to make sure that the picture's right, the exposure's right. I was shooting video, which is something I haven't done very much of. But when I got it back, it was 9 seconds. The whole thing lasted for 9 seconds, but I'll never forget it.
Mm. Well, I know that you care deeply about marine conservation, and you founded Whale Trust. It's a marine research and education organization based in Maui. What research are you most excited about when it comes to the stuff we don't know about whales?
Well, one of the things that changed how we think about whales, there was a cusp in the late 60s and 70s, we went from a hunting myth to a preservation myth with cetaceans. And Song of the Humpback Whale was played to Congress in 1970. And you've all heard the song. The biggest record, first printing ever, was National Geographic's 10 million copies of the Song of the Humpback Whale in 1979. And that song is something we've studied. I came into supporting this work in 1996. I had a windfall, and I contacted Dr. Jim Darling, who's an expert in whale song, and the behavior around it. And just trying to find out what that song means. It captured the public. It captured our attention. We still don't know really what it means. And I really feel to understand what song is, we'll have to know the whole social system of humpback whales. And that's just a great thing to chase.
And Flip, I know that not everyone can do what you do, but what do you want us to know about why we should all care about whales, even if we've never seen one ourselves?
Well, I don't want to say whales aren't important. They've been very important to me. But whales need a clean ocean, a healthy ocean, and food to eat. They need all the things we need. So they're a great icon for the health of the sea. And the health of the sea should be important to all of us, whether we really care about whales or not.
Flip, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Flip Nicklin is one of the world's leading marine photographers, decades of experience behind him. He's the author of the book Among Giants, A Life with Whales.
He'll be speaking at Madison's Overture Center tomorrow night at 7:30 p.m. Now, in recent years, DNA testing has exonerated individuals who were wrongfully convicted because of misconduct by FBI forensic scientists. As Alexandra Hall reports, a nationwide review of flawed hair analysis is calling into question the outcomes of over a dozen cases here in Wisconsin.
Thank you, Your Honor, Robert Kaiser and Aaron Hansen on behalf of the state of Wisconsin.
At a hearing in Dane County Circuit Court in February, attorneys with the Innocence Project appeared alongside a man named Richard Baranek and asked the judge who gave him a life sentence for a retrial.
So this case involves a sexual assault that occurred 30 years ago.
Richard Baranek was convicted of sexually assaulting a woman in rural Stoughton in 1990. Despite multiple alibi witnesses who said he was in North Dakota at the time, the victim picked him out of a lineup. At the trial, an FBI forensic analyst told the jury that a single hair found on a pair of men's underwear left by the perpetrator matched the hair on Baranek's head. In February, Innocence Project attorneys presented DNA testing that showed that hair was not Baranek's.
We also think that this case is important just for the criminal justice system in general to recognize when mistakes are made and correct them.
Baranek's case is far from an anomaly. The FBI is currently reviewing thousands of cases around the country in which examiners from the agency's Hairs and Fibers Unit gave testimony in court that went beyond the limits of science. At least 13 of those cases, possibly linking people to crimes they did not commit, are in Wisconsin.
Forensic science was built in crime laboratories. It did not follow the path of true science.
That's Frederick Whitehurst. He worked as an explosives expert for the FBI for years. Whitehurst says he noticed in the 90s that his reports were being changed without his authorization to reflect certainty.
Nobody is willing in forensic science to speak about the uncertainties, and that makes it not science. Most of the people I knew in the crime lab, especially in the hair analysis unit, are good people. They believed in what they were doing. They were not scientists.
Part of what makes ignoring that uncertainty dangerous is that juries can be inclined to believe experts who have the FBI's authority behind them. A hair examined beneath a microscope can tell you a few things. If it's from a human, and if it is what race the person is, plus what part of the body it came from. But it can't be relied on to tell you exactly who the hair came from. Skip Palahniuk is a forensic scientist who analyzed evidence in cases like the Oklahoma City bombing and the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. He says FBI analysts overstated what they knew.
One of the agents used to say, well, I think the chances are of this hair being from somebody else is slim to none, and Slim just left town. So that leaves the jury with the impression, this is coming from the FBI, that, boy, that's probably that guy's hair.
In 2015, the FBI announced that a review of hundreds of cases where hair analysis was used over the years found examiners made statements that were scientifically inaccurate at least 90% of the time. Keith Finley, who is co-director of the Wisconsin Innocence Project and is working on the Barana case, says problems in Wisconsin don't stop with the FBI.
The FBI trained many, many state-level crime laboratory analysts in the same methods, and those people were probably going out into the field providing the same kinds of scientifically invalid testimony.
So far, 1,600 FBI cases have been reviewed, and that number is growing. In certain cases, faulty hair analysis was inconsequential. Sometimes defendants were guilty regardless of what the FBI said. But in cases where it was a deciding factor, Finley says it's not just in the interest of fairness to set the record straight. The public also has a stake. In the case of Richard Baranek, if he is found innocent, whoever's hair that really was could still be out there somewhere, free. Alexandra Hall, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That story was produced in collaboration with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism.
Joining us now to take a deeper look into this issue, we have Dee Hall with us, managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Dee, thanks for joining us.
All right, thanks a lot.
Also with us, Jarrett Adams, attorney with the Innocence Project, which took up Baranek's case. When he was a teenager, Jarrett was wrongfully convicted of a crime in Wisconsin, exonerated nearly a decade later. Jarrett, welcome back to the show.
Thank you guys for having me.
Well, Dee, let's start with you. You've been reporting on this issue as well. Is this a big movement in Wisconsin courts to look back at this forensic evidence related to hair and maybe change rulings?
Well, actually, part of the problem with this hair analysis is there isn't much movement on it. It is being cases are being analyzed. They are being determined whether or not the hair analysis was flawed or whether it was scientifically sound. But then until the last couple of years, those determinations were largely kept away from defendants and their attorneys. And so even if they found egregious breaches of scientific integrity, you know, completely flawed testimony, the defendants and their attorneys weren't being notified. And so one of our goals is to write about this to try to figure out where are these cases and have the appropriate people been notified.
Yeah, who's who has this information that would be at their discretion, I guess, to let the defense, to let the convicted person know?
So it is being done right now. There's a joint effort by the Innocence Project in New York and the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, as well as the Department of Justice and FBI, to take a look at these cases in which the Hairs and Fibers Unit analysts testified. So what was happening until about 2014, some of these before the Office of the Inspector General came in, in many cases, they were doing the analyses, and then the defendants were not being notified. Since then, it is the policy to have the defense notified after an analysis is completed.
And Jarrett Adams, let's bring you in on this now. As we heard in that piece, jurors would look at this evidence, maybe from the FBI, presented as solid evidence. How influential is that going to be on a juror if an FBI analyst says, yes, slim to none, that this is anybody but the accused?
I mean, it's hugely important because you have to understand that the evidence isn't being presented, you know, just as a throw-in. In many cases, it's being presented to break a tie, so to speak, where you have defense witnesses who are saying, look, my client wasn't there. And there are certain witnesses that are saying, look, he wasn't there. But then you have another witness from the state that is saying, look, it was your client who did it. That hair analysis is a tiebreaker. And when a jury is faced with that, I mean, you know, any person would be inclined to rely on that.
And when we look at forensic evidence in a courtroom beyond just hair, what can a defense attorney do to challenge the validity of that kind of evidence?
And so this is something else that has been mentioned by Dee in the coverage up there. It goes by how many resources that you have. Like, how do you have the resources to go up against the state's crime lab when they have FBI agents at their disposal to come and testify, and their testimony isn't just neutral. It's weighted towards believing that their years of experience and how they were trained, that they're accurately comparing this and saying that, look, this hair was attributed to this person and it originated from this person, and that type of language is very deceiving. So if you don't have the resources to hire and combat that with other experts, like, you're really up a creek without a paddle.
And D, this hair evidence, it was presented as what I understand to be on the reliability level of like fingerprinting. We each have our own unique fingerprint, as I understand it, and it was being presented as though if you put my hair in a powerful microscope, it was going to identify me and no one else.
Right, and what happened was, and the reason this became completely discredited, was DNA came along, and you can actually test a hair for what its DNA composition, and in fact what they found out was these hairs that were being called, quote, a match to a suspect were not theirs at all. And that happened in the Baronic case as well. There was the hair left in the underwear. It was supposedly a match, according to the FBI, to Mr. Baronic, and subsequent DNA testing has excluded him as the source of that hair. And so that's when the whole science, quote-unquote science of it, just began to unravel, when case after case, and we had at least two here in Wisconsin, in which the DNA testing completely excluded the individuals as the source after they'd been called as consistent with the suspect.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jared.
Now, I was going to say, Dee's absolutely right. I believe the other case is Armstrong, where he, you know, where it was proven. When you compare hairs, the science now tells us that some hairs can look like that of originating from the person that they want to attribute it to. But the DNA has proven now that just because hairs look alike, that does not mean that they are from the same person.
Right, and Dee, you write that part of the problem here was that the experts and the people trained by them were saying they'd looked at millions, billions of threads of hair and could tell one from another.
Well, in the Baronic case, the FBI analyst made the, I mean, we have to say, absurd claim that he had analyzed billions of hairs, and I just did a little math, and you'd have to do 322,000 hairs every day of every year that he was in the FBI crime lab. So in other words, there was some exaggeration going on there, and his testimony was filled with it.
And go ahead, Jarrett.
I was going to say that case is the prime example of what I just mentioned in breaking the tie. There was absolutely no physical evidence that linked Mr. Baranek to this crime. So when the prosecution put up the testimony of an FBI agent saying that this hair was similar to that of Mr. Baranek, I mean, who do you think the jury sided with?
Well, I will say there wasn't physical evidence, but there were witnesses who placed him 600 miles away in North Dakota at the time, and though the testimony of those witnesses was basically disregarded once you had the expert up there saying that this hair was a match for Mr. Baranek.
We're looking at a report that found that Wisconsin, other states, and the FBI used flawed forensic evidence from human hairs to convict innocent people, it turned out, after DNA testing was done years later. Dee Hall is a journalist who produced a report on that. Jarrett Adams, attorney with the Innocence Project, which has been probing into criminal cases that use this kind of flawed hair evidence.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Are you concerned about the use of forensic evidence in court? If you work in criminal justice, we want to know what your reaction is to this. You can share your thoughts on wrongful convictions in Wisconsin. You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about a new report that found that Wisconsin and other states used flawed forensic evidence from hairs to convict innocent people. Dee Hall has been reporting on this, and Jarrett Adams is with us too, an attorney with the Innocence Project, which has been probing into criminal cases that used flawed hair evidence.
We want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Tell us what your thoughts are on forensic evidence being used in criminal justice cases. Are you concerned about the evidence that's presented to juries? If you work in criminal justice or you've been on a jury where forensic evidence has been presented, we'd love to hear from you and your experiences. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Jarrett, I've heard that lawyers, especially defense attorneys, are concerned about forensic evidence because of what people see in popular culture. Everything from Sherlock Holmes to CSI, we see these miraculous technological connections made to catch the bad guy. Is this something that skews people's perception when they get on a jury?
I mean, yeah. I mean, it is. And the thing about it is, unfortunately, in our society, it's the opposite of what it says when it says that you're innocent until proven guilty. I mean, you must prove that you are absolutely innocent in a lot of cases, depending on who you are and the resources that you have. And so the science plays a huge factor in this. I mean, our society has accepted science in terms of finding a defendant guilty, but we should also accept it when it proves that a person is innocent.
And working with the Innocence Project, Jarrett, do you think that judges and prosecutors are as open as they should be to reviewing cases where evidence turns out to have been flawed?
It depends on it. And I don't want to paint with such a broad brush and say all you know, prosecutors and judges are ignoring the evidence. But it seems like in certain cases that the evidence is being challenged in a manner of, all right, so we're not going to challenge the results. We're just going to challenge the chain of custody. And that's if you're doing that, then you're having an argument that believes more in finality than you do in justice. And it's just not fair.
And, Dee, I should ask, I assume we're not testing this way anymore now that we have DNA. We're not just trying to fingerprint, in quotes, our hair samples?
Right. The state crime lab stopped using it about 20 years ago. There's some slight value in using it, but only to differentiate, like, animal versus human hair, for example, or different races. Could that possibly have come from that person? Well, no, that person is white and this hair is from an African-American or a person of African origin. So, you know, so there's a little bit of use to it, but it's certainly not to identify people. And they've actually known that for over 20 years.
I want to bring in a caller now. We've got Joseph on the line in Madison. Joseph, hi.
Yes, this hello, Dee, Jarrett. I believe that the forensic science is ultimate because in my case, it took 23 years before we were able to prove beyond a doubt that the DNA was right from the get-go. Fortunately, the science got better over the years, and we were able to do a finite test that wasn't available originally, even though the original tests proved that it wasn't me in the first place.
So you're saying, Joseph, you were ultimately exonerated in a case because of DNA testing?
After 23 years, yes.
All right. Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that experience.
Thanks for calling in, Joseph.
Jarrett, how much is DNA testing changing the landscape of exoneration?
I mean, it's definitely the movement is continuing to move, and you can see that there's an increase in the number of exonerations each year, and that's because the science is catching up, and we should, as a society, allow it to catch up. I mean, we accept advances in everything in society, whether it be our phones, our cars, and so we should allow that same advancement to continue to happen in the criminal justice system. Because at this point, we understand and we see that a lot of times justice is defined by who you are and what you have. And I continue to say that thing because I want people to understand that for the most part, people who have resources and who are wealthy only go to jail when they commit crimes against other wealthy people. Meanwhile, people who are poor are continued to be taken advantage of. A lot of the representation that they have, and Dee put out another report on this, a lot of the representation that people that we find have in these wrongful conviction cases are people who are assigned public defenders and public defenders who aren't using investigators. I mean, just imagine not even using an investigator in a case where your life is on the line and there's been science used against you in that same case. So I think that we need to continue to advance as a society. This isn't about pointing the finger at the prosecutor or the judge and saying that they're wrong. This is about pointing the finger at a solution and making sure that we get it right in our society.
Joseph, thanks for that call. And Jarrett saying there, Dee, we're talking about physical evidence. Physical evidence isn't always the story in a wrongful conviction or an exoneration story. Sometimes there's no relevant physical evidence to go back
right,
and
retest. That's a real problem. But they have looked at DNA exoneration. So these are ones in which you obviously have biological evidence. And 20% of the DNA exonerations in the United States now involved hair analysis that turned out to be completely false.
Yeah.
Talking to Dee Hall from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism and attorney Jarrett Adams. Our starting point, a big change, looking back at cases that were swayed by hair analysis flawed. We found out later hair analysis often disproven by DNA testing when that came along. Back to your calls now with Tony on the line in Fenimore. Tony, hi.
Yeah, hi. I was actually a juror in a case where they were trying to get us to convict a guy that they had a boot print in the snow that was the left boot print, And the picture of the guy's boot once they arrested this guy was of the right boot. And, I mean, it looked like the same boot, but when we looked at it, you could tell that it was left versus right, and they were trying to get us to convict this guy using completely left versus right. And it's like, this is completely different evidence, you know?
Well, Tony actually brings up a really interesting point. A lot of the so-called quote-unquote pattern analysis that forensic evidence has been discredited when they look at, like, the stripes on a bullet or, you know, tire tracks, a lot of that has been found that it is bite marks is a classic.
Bite mark, yeah.
It doesn't match up. It has no scientific validity.
Yeah, Jared, I mean, how often do you see things like this in cases where it appears that evidence presented is either actually ambiguous or doesn't match up?
Oh, my God. We definitely see it a lot. I mean, especially with what D just mentioned as far as, like, bite mark evidence. I mean, we've even seen forensic evidence being used in fire cases where it's like, an accidental fire may happen, and then there are scientists who come in and testify and say, look, I'm an expert. I study the pattern of burns, and this is an intentional fire. And like I said before, when a jury hears that, that's extremely prejudicial when a jury hears that. And in a lot of cases, especially in the case of Mr. where he had six witnesses who've testified that he was in a different place. And just alone, we can see that this hair analysis was enough to sway the jury to discredit six witnesses, not one or two, six witnesses who testified he was in a different state at the time.
And I wanted to ask, Jared, you're working with Mr. Baranek now, what's going through his mind as this hair evidence, such as it was, is getting reviewed?
Well, I mean, he's just remaining hopeful. He really is. And I've gotten a chance to get to know him more, and also his family and his mother, who's still around. And one of the things that really, really almost, you know, brought me to tears was when she pulled me to the side and she told me, she says, look, I put him on the bus to go to North Dakota. So I didn't know where he was, and I testified to that. And yet and still, that hair analysis was enough to discredit her testimony along with the five other witnesses.
And Dee, as we wrap up, our other cases in Wisconsin seeing movement now on this hair analysis issue?
Well, a lot of them aren't known, but we were able to figure out one other case of Patrick Greer, a man in La Crosse County who had been convicted in 1995 of a masked armed robbery of a bank. He had always claimed that he was innocent, but there was some hair evidence that showed that tied him to the crime. And it turns out that analyst gave scientifically invalid testimony, including telling jurors that his ability to match hairs was just like your ability to see your spouse or your best friend in a crowded room.
We'll leave it there. Dee, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
And Jared, thanks to you as well.
All right. Thank you.
We're talking to Dee Hall from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism and Jarrett Adams, attorney with the Innocence Project, looking at hair analysis, some cases being overturned now based on hair analysis by DNA evidence.